Shalom, everybody. Welcome back to the third part of the Rites of Passage teaching. I hope that you have all been really enjoying this study. For me, it's been an immense blessing that the Father has unveiled this to me through my studies and through His Spirit. This has just been an absolutely amazing subject to study. And really what it's going to boil down to is, in this third and final video, is kind of putting it all together. And this is why it's been so amazing for me, is because it's finally allowed me to be able to understand a lot more of the amazing things in the Tanakh, in the Old Testament, but really what it boils down to is it helps me understand how our lives as believers are supposed to progress, and also to unveil a lot of the mysteries, if we want to call them that, in the New Testament writings, in the first century writings. Because for the longest time, we've all been taught that Paul taught against the Torah, you know, and they'll give us these proof texts where he's against the Torah. But then, we come into Messianic Hebrew roots, whatever you want to call yourself, a mindset, and we suddenly start seeing Paul from a different angle. We see that he did uphold the Torah. But then there's still a lot of verses out there that are, you know, seem to be anti-Torah, and we got pro-Torah verses. So what is this all about? How are we to reconcile these differences? I know there have been people who have just completely rejected Paul because they haven't understood his writings. And, you know, the more I study into the ancient Near Eastern culture and mindset, and especially with the rite of passage, I really have begun to understand what Paul was actually saying, and the beauty, the simplicity, and the profoundness of his writings, because a lot of his writings are dealing with certain phases in the believer's life and certain phases in the rites of passage, because the rites of passage apply to various stages in the believer's life, but they also apply to our life in general as well. And so we're going to see here there's a lot of different applications here. Now, I want you to, I hope you'd printed out this drawing here that I posted on the website. If you haven't, it's on the website. It's on the PowerPoints. I'd highly recommend either you print it out or at least have it pulled up while you're watching this video, because this will help you out. So let's just start off by reviewing this so we can get this refreshed in our minds. For those of you who aren't watching all three videos at once. So with the rites of passage, remember, we're transitioning from a normal state to a normal state. And in between, there's a liminal state where there's either like an elevated status of holiness, or there's a reduced status of holiness, like in the case of a mourner, where they go into a state where they kind of sympathize with the dead, or they kind of enter into a death-like state in order to mourn for that. And while in the cases of like mourning, we go from normal state to normal state, and they're the same condition from side to side, oftentimes we'll see this happening in an elevation or a de-elevation or a reduction of a status. For example, the high priest, when he would go into the, prior to going into the Holy of Holies, he would go through a rites of passage where he would go through these different steps, and he'd go out, come in as a holiness, just as a priest essentially, and on the other side he exits at a higher level of holiness so that he's actually able to go into the Creator's presence. And then afterwards he has to go through another rites of passage to basically consecrate himself, to reduce his holiness status so that he can actually interact with normal people without causing interactions between holiness and or extreme holiness and commonality, which of course we know, you know, being common isn't a bad thing. It's the ground state of Israel, but that ground state of an Israelite cannot enter into the holiness of Yahweh. They have to proceed up the ladder, and only when invited as well. No one, you know, you couldn't just find out the steps and then go through all these steps yourself and just walk into the Holy of Holies. You had to be invited. It was all about invitation into God's presence. So looking at this, we first see that at the beginning of this period of the rites of passage, we have the rites of separation, where the person would separate out from their old self. This would be a symbolic death and rebirth. Frequently, they would frequently purify, possibly shaving of the hair, things like this. They're basically cutting themselves off from their old ways, from the old person that they were, and then they enter into this liminal period. Remember, the word liminal means threshold. It's that state of ambiguity, like if you're passing through the threshold of your house. During that step, you're both inside your house and you're also outside your house for that moment in time. And so these rites of passage, what they do is they define that. They set clear boundaries on either side here. And we know that they typically, in the scriptures, last 7 days, especially when we're dealing with things with time and things. But not always. I mean, they could last 40 days, they could last a lifetime, they could last a matter of a day, or even less than a day. This person, typically, remember, we're talking in generalities. These rites can be different with each different person, or each different passage. But typically, the person is isolated from society during that time. And what's going to be really important is that this is a training period. And when you're training, you're under the tutelage of someone, right? You have, just like when you're in school, that's essentially a rite of passage. You're in a liminal state where you're under the tutorship of a teacher. And so you're training, and then there's also going to be trials and testing to make sure that you're comprehending and integrating all of these new things that you're learning. Just like with the Aaronite priesthood, in Leviticus 8 and 9, when they're inducted into it, they have 7 days, which it doesn't tell us, and a lot of times the text doesn't tell us what's going on during this time period. It's just assumed that we understand that during this time period, they would be going through intense training so that they could understand how to do their jobs when they're finally incorporated in. Now remember, as soon as they hit that rite of passage, they were priests. But they weren't incorporated, they weren't fully integrated into their position so that they could officiate for the rest of the people. But they, at that point in time, as soon as they separated, they were priests at that time. Just like when I went into boot camp, as soon as I got to boot camp and they shaved my head and they gave me a uniform, I was in the military. From that minute on, I was receiving a military paycheck. But while I'm in boot camp, I don't have the same responsibilities or even the same privileges necessarily as the members that are fully integrated into the military, and they're out there actually fighting in the wars, operating the ships, and all that sort of thing. It's that training period that's preparing me for full integration into the community, but I was still a military member. That's very, very key to remember here, is what we'll be talking about. Oftentimes they're referred to as being set apart. Being in that holy status, they're at an elevated status. Just like during the feast days, right? The feast days are a liminal passage. They're a rite of passage between one season to the next. And during that time, we looked at Numbers 25, I believe it was, what we call the sacrificial calendar, where it talks about all the different sacrifices that are performed during each of the feast days. Why would they perform these sacrifices? Well, when you look at the function of these sacrifices, of the olah offering, they weren't to purify someone from sin. They weren't for forgiveness of sins. The purpose of the olah offering is for consecration. It's for elevating one's status. And that's why they had to offer these offerings during this liminal period, is because during the feast days, all of Israel has an elevated holy status, because that is the time that they're supposed to meet with. That's a set apart meeting with God Himself, with Yahweh. And so if you're going to have a meeting with Him, you need to be in an elevated status, right? Otherwise, it's just you couldn't come in a profane state and enter into His presence. That's very clearly defined in all of the priestly writing, in Leviticus and in Numbers, especially. So that was the function, is that during the feast days, they elevated the status, and that's why they needed those offerings. And then finally, we get to that last part where they, that last little line there, where they would have the rites of incorporation. This is now, you're now no longer in training. You're now no longer that old person. You are now fully incorporated into the priesthood, into whatever it is you're going into. And so oftentimes there would be a sacrifice involved, because that would be that final state of elevating you up to that new higher level. Consecrating to renew the person, and you're essentially integrating. And what it really does, what it boils down to, is it sets up a clear boundary in the minds of the people. They understood that clearly now you are in this role. There was no question about it. You had that ceremony. Just like when you go through schooling, when you finally get to the final part of the 12th grade and you go through that graduation ceremony, as soon as that ceremony is over, now you have that certificate. Now there's no question in anyone's mind as to whether or not you are a high school graduate, that you have transitioned to a new part in your life. And that's why when you apply for a job as a teenager who's graduated, when you start applying for your first jobs, they'll ask you, do you have your high school certificate or GED equivalent, right? That's a proof that you've clearly crossed that boundary marker of adolescence into adulthood. And now you're able to act as an adult in that role there. So I want to read a couple little passages here from this incredible book I've started reading. It's called Graded Holiness, A Key to Priestly Concepts of the World. And let me see who wrote it. It's by Philip Peter Jensen. Really incredible book here. I'm really enjoying it. I'm about halfway through it, and I'm definitely going to integrate this into a lot of my future teachings, because it's really profound with a lot of the stuff with the Levitical system. But anyways, down here on page 65, near the bottom of it, and he actually has this exact same picture that Van Gennep uses, that we talked about with, and I'll put it up here on the screen in a little bit, with the rites of passage, and it has the, well, you know what, let's just show it to you here. You should be able to see that there, that little picture there. He uses that picture in there to kind of talk about it with the little lines there. And he talks about, let me see where I wanted to read at here. This was really interesting. He says, the rites of passage satisfy the psychological needs of the individuals undergoing a life crisis, as well as the needs of the community for creating and maintaining throughout the generations an agreed set of values and a way of life. Particularly of interest is the observation that what is appropriate for marginal state or liminal state is often in opposition to that which is the rule of everyday life. So what he's talking about here is it satisfies the individual needs of the individual. We all need to know that we've passed that point in our life. I mean, you think about like the bar mitzvah and a lot of those things. It's a clear point now. You know, once you've overcome that, once you've graduated from school, now you know for certain that you are ready for the next phase of your life. And it also satisfies the needs of the community for maintaining these values and this way of life. You know, a lot of times it's very unfortunate. I hear a lot of people, and I don't mean to harp on people, because I feel that it's really just a kind of a lack of understanding. There's nothing wrong with the people. It's just they haven't been presented in the correct manner. The understanding of rituals and the true beauty and function of rituals. A lot of times it seems like the system of Christianity has really come with this anti-Jewish attitude against anything that's considered ritualistic behavior. But I really feel that is a bad way to look at things, because rituals, they ingrain values in a way of life. And you think about it, I mean, look at the world today. Look at how we've gone away from the so-called traditional ways of doing things. Traditional means, i.e., the ritualistic. This is the way things are done. when you don't do things in a set manner that's been put out for a long time, you start to lose your values. And I mean, look at the people today. They're in this state that they don't know. That, you know, they feel like they're you know, tossed to and fro by the wind and the waves, and you know, who knows what's right and wrong. And it's really sad. So the rites of passage is a way of maintaining that. I mean, think about it. If we just said, you know, who needs the school system? Who needs colleges and degrees? I mean, because look, I went through high school. I went through college. I've gone through two different degree programs. Did either one of those realistically help me for my job? Well, realistically, probably about 10 to 20% of what I learned was actually helpful, and the rest of it, I never even use, right? But it's a way of setting clear boundaries. And so, and really what I learned in college was how to study, how to go about and find this information, which has obviously really helped me here, because, you know, that's half of doing these studies is figuring out, how do you get this information? How do you discern the information? And obviously, I'm not discounting God's Spirit from doing that, because I believe that without God's Spirit, I would be in bed with the rest of these people denying the validity of the Torah. But kind of digressing there. So anyways, you know, without having college degrees to maintain those boundaries, anyone could just come up and say, well, I'm going to be a nurse, I want to be an astronaut, and without any sort of training, without any sort of showing that you have the ability to do your job correctly, without any sort of certification, they go into that role, and when they're not qualified. And that's the importance of this. And there's one more verse here, just to kind of reiterate with this. This is on page 74. This was another really interesting thing. Same book, this graded holiness. And he writes, conformity to the rules is largely a matter of habit, but explicit sanctions reinforce obedience. It is dangerous to cross boundaries, since the transgression of a normal or normality can provoke a reaction from whoever or whatever is associated with preservation of the order, whether demons, God, or the gods, and we're talking about the mindset of people in general, nature, or society. Identification of the agent in this reaction is often ambiguous and undefined, and more than one sanction can operate. The primary concern is often the preservation of order through the appropriate retribution or ritual, rather than the consequence incurred by overstepping the bounds. So what they're talking about here is just what he's been talking about here is just what I was talking about with like the high priesthood. You have to be invited into the Holy of Holies in the temple. You don't just waltz in there. There's boundaries, and by crossing those boundaries, you set not only yourself at danger, but you set the whole nation at danger. What happened to Nadav and Abihu when they tried to cross those boundaries of how they're supposed to be performing their ritual? It says they brought strange fire, which basically means that the level of holiness of the fire that they were bringing was not appropriate for the level of holiness of which the place they were trying to enter was at. So without taking those proper steps to match the level of holiness, they create what we could essentially call a mismatch in holiness. If you want to almost think about it as it's not electricity, but we can think of it in terms as an analogy of electricity, right? When you have a highly positive charge and a highly negative charge, what happens? Well, just like what we see with lightning goes, and technically lightning goes from the ground to the sky, but we see this massive lightning bolt happen, and the same analogy, or that's a very good analogy for what happens when you have two potentials. You have the super holiness of God and a common status, or even a not high enough holy status of this fire of this person. Instant death occurred there. The fire came out from God and killed them instantly. And that's why the priests and the Levites were charged with guarding the tabernacle. You know, a foreigner was not even allowed into the courts. because of this mismatch, this profanity that could be brought in, and the danger that it could cause. And for us, you know, a lot of times we think of this as being primitive, as, oh, you know, that's kind of silly, but that's we're taking our 21st century mindset and trying to apply it to something that happened 3,500 years ago. You cannot do that. The cultures are so different. You know, I was actually just thinking about this today. In the news, I've heard it several times. Maybe it wasn't the news. Maybe I don't. Somewhere recently, I've heard them talk about one of the major problems with the war on terrorism is that we actually think that just because the Muslim society in the Middle East today, to us it looks primitive because they don't have, their society is different from ours. They don't have the same things that we do, so we look at them as primitive. And that's been one of the major problems with the war on terrorism, is that we think that they're just a bunch of primitives, a bunch of cavemen, if you will, whereas they actually, they have a different society. And yes, I'm not saying that, you know, anything, I'm not trying to condone anything that the terrorists do, but we can't look at them like they're cavemen just because they don't all have the latest, you know, Samsung Galaxy phone or iPhone, and they don't drive around new cars and all this stuff. That doesn't mean that they are primitive in their mindset. Just like we can't look at the people in the Torah and go, oh, well, they didn't have, you know, running water, they didn't have this and that, so they must have been primitive imbeciles. That's not the case at all. And I know most of you don't, or hopefully none of you believe that, but that tends to be the prevailing notion, and especially like the underlying notion. No one will come out and say that a lot of times, but they'll imply that with everything they're doing. So I know that was kind of a long introduction here, but let's get right into it. And because here in this part, we're going to really look into application of the rites of passage to the first century writings, because there's a lot there, and they're actually quite profound. The first one I want to talk about is Yeshua's legal passage to messiahship. Just because Yeshua is divine, because he comes from the Father, doesn't mean that he doesn't have to go through the same steps as everyone else in order to be elevated to these statuses. I mean, I know Rico's talked about it in one of his Torah portions, that Yeshua was anointed, and the purpose of anointing oil in the ancient Near East was to elevate one's status. So we have to look at Yeshua and see how in his lifetime he was legally elevated to messiahship. And where we really see this at is in Matthew 3 and 4. And I'm not going to read through the account because we all know the story, right? Yeshua comes down to the River Jordan, and John the Baptist sees him there, Yochanan the Immerser, and he declares him, "Behold the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world," right? And so Yeshua goes down and he becomes immersed in the river. Now, why is that? Why did he have to be immersed if he's the Son of God? Because it was a rite of passage. He was passing from who he was born as, and he was starting to legally enter into his messiahship. You notice that up until that point, he didn't go around teaching the kingdom of heaven. He didn't go about doing the work of his Father in that manner. Right? So he's mikvahed in the River Jordan, in the Yarden River. And then we know that the dove ascends out of heaven, and Yahweh legally adopts him. He claims him as his son. And if you don't understand that, Rico has an incredible teaching on the laws of adoption where he talks about this. And so he calls him his son, and which is code for legal adoption. And we've got to remember that the term the Son of God is not a claim on divinity. The term son of Adam, son of man, or son of man, son of Enosh, or son of man, son of Adam, those terminologies, and you can look into rabbinical literature. There's a great book, I don't have it with me because I lent it out to someone, by Daniel Boyerin. I don't remember the name of it now. But it talks about this. It talks about how the son of Adam, the son of man, is a title that was associated with in rabbinical literature in the time with divinity, whereas the Son of God is not divinity. Every single king in the ancient Near East and in the world that Yeshua lived in referred to themselves as the Son of God. It was not a claim that he was divine. Now, we're not saying he's not divine because we know he calls himself the Son of Man. But it was a claim that he had the right to the kingship over Israel. And so when Yahweh adopts him, we see here in Matthew 37, or Matthew 37, Matthew 3, verse 17, a voice from heaven saying, "This is my son," a voice from heaven claiming him as his son. So it's adoption, but in the concept of legally adopting him into kingship. And remember, that's what Messiah was all about. Because remember, King David was the Messiah. He was Mashiach. He was anointed, the anointed one. And so he says, "This is my son, the beloved, in whom I am well pleased." Right? So he legally claims him for adoption. Remember when after King David was anointed, he didn't immediately assume leadership, did he? No, he had to go through that period of time, that rites of passage between when he was anointed king and when he was the crowned king over all of Israel. And so between that time for King David, what did he have to go through? He had to go through a lot of trials and tribulations. He was constantly at odds with King Saul during that time, and he started slowly taking over the kingdom at that time. But and so we'll see those things line up with the life of Yeshua. Now, when we go to Matthew 4, we can look here on the screen. And it says, "And Yeshua was led by the Spirit into the wilderness and to be tried by the devil. And after having fasted for 40 days and 40 nights, he was hungry. And the trier comes out to him and said, 'If you're the son of Elohim, command that these stones be turned into bread.' But he answered, 'Is not there it is written that man shall not live by bread alone, but by what comes from the word of the mouth of Yahweh.'" And of course, and we can go on through the whole scenario there, and I'll let you read the rest yourself there. But I want you to notice there, it says he was led by the Spirit. Yeshua was led by the Spirit. What is that concept there? He's led by the Spirit, i.e., just like teachers lead their students into greater understanding, Yeshua is led by the Spirit. He's under the tutor of the Spirit, the tutelage of the Spirit, right? So clearly, at this point in time, we can see he is in a transitional period. It's 40 days. 40 is the number of trial and testing. And we see here that he fasts, he's very hungry. And then at the end of it, just like at the end of your school year, what do you have? You have trials and testing to see if you are ready to be incorporated in. And so Hasatan comes here and he starts to try Yeshua to see if he will actually live up to being Yahweh's Mashiach, the one who's come to save us. And really, what this comes down to is it's essentially it's just like that trial in the garden between the serpent and Adam and Chava, because I believe Adam was there with her. And I believe the trial was for him, and he completely failed by not even saying anything, right? And so Satan tempts him in this very same way. He tries to get him. He tries to get him to command to command bread, to for this. He takes him to this city, or to this cliff overlooking the city, and tells him to throw himself off there, which is essentially kind of like it's very similar to this trial by, excuse me, trial by divine ordeal. He's saying, throw yourself off and see if God will save you. Just like in the ancient Near East, they would take an adulterous woman and they would throw her in the river to see if the God of the river would save her. Very same concept of putting God to the test here. He was essentially trying to put God on trial through Yeshua, just like that's what the serpent in the garden did. Is he used Adam and Chava to put the Creator on trial. And we all know how that turned out, of course. And then, of course, he finishes up by trying to get him to worship him. And so Yeshua, as the last Adam, he overcame what Israel and what Adam failed to overcome. Israel was tried in the wilderness for 40 years, right? And they failed at that. And as a result, only two of them made it in the promised land. Adam and Chava were tried at the tree of knowledge of good and evil, and they failed. And as a result, they weren't able to enter into that eternal rest. Yeshua, on the other hand, he did overcome the trials. He passed through that rites of passage and was able to be incorporated in. And this is where, you know, you can kind of pull out different parts in the life of Yeshua. We see that Yeshua could not actually begin in his role as the Mashiach, really, until the death of John the Baptist, of John the Immerser. We also see that Yeshua right now Yeshua is the anointed king, and he's been declared the king of Judah, but he's not, with the writing over the cross on his head, but he is not, just like King David, he's not the crown king over all of Israel until his return. He's their king in our hearts, but he's not yet the crowned king over all of Israel as of yet. He will in the very near future, praise God. But, you know, we see these things, and really, you know, that I believe that's part of where the death of Yeshua kind of plays in, is that was part of that incorporation. Because remember, during the rites of incorporation, there often was required a sacrifice, an offering for consecration. And isn't that what, oftentimes the writers in the New Testament talk about, is that he's what sanctifies us, what elevates our status up to holiness? And so I believe that was the purpose there. So when we look at the writings of Paul, and Paul is so amazing when it comes to this, we see the we see what happens with the rites the conversion from a Gentile, because remember the term Gentile is used for a pagan. Once you become a believer in Messiah, you are no longer a Gentile. You're now a citizen with the saints. But that second you accept Yeshua into your life and you convert, that doesn't put you at the same point as everyone else, because you don't know the Torah. You don't know everything. There's a time of learning. And as we're going to see here, this is exactly what Paul... This was what the whole argument was in the first century. The Pharisees said, no, as soon as you want to become a believer, you get circumcised, you are immediately a fully integrated into Israel, which means the second you believe, the minute that you want to become a believer, and the minute you become circumcised, now you have all the same rights and responsibilities as everyone else. What Paul was saying is, no, there has to be a transitional period. You don't just go from being a toddler to being an adult overnight, do you? No one expects your toddler to just one day wake up and act like an adult and, you know, be able to go out and have a job and be able to read and write and all this stuff. So why were we expecting the believers to, the minute they accept faith in Yeshua, that immediately that they're going to suddenly, you know, be able to keep the Torah to the level that the grounded believers are, that the mature believers are? And so We have the rites of passage. So we have the rites of separation. We see here, you've got to separate from your old self, remember, which is symbolic of death and rebirth, purifying yourself and leaving the old ways. So we have the confession of faith, and we all know you have the baptism or mikvah, whatever you want to call it. And then, what do we have next? Let's turn to Acts chapter 15. And see what Paul is talking about here. Acts chapter 15, we'll read verse 3 real fast. So being sent on their way by the assembly, they passed through Phoenicia and Shomron, or Samaria, relating the conversion of Gentiles, and they were great, and they were causing great joy with all the brothers. So here we see that this passage is talking about the conversion of the Gentiles. You can see it here on the screen. Conversion of the Gentiles right there. That is what is being discussed in Acts chapter 15. So we look down here at verse 19 through 21. And most of us are familiar with all of this here. And it reads, therefore, and you know, this is brought before the council, remember. And the council has heard both sides, and they're going to make a legal decree here. Therefore, I judge that we should not trouble those among the Gentiles who are turning to Elohim. So, what are they talking about here? They're talking about those among the Gentiles who are turning to Elohim. Not who have turned to Elohim, but they are turning to Elohim. But that we write to them to abstain from defilements of idols and whoring and from that what is strangled and from blood. So what they're saying is that when these people are turning to Elohim, these are the four things here that they have to abstain from. These are how they separate themselves out from their old ways. And there's plenty of teachings out there. I know Tony Robinson talks about it. I know Rico has talked about it in the past. That show that these four things, this defilement from idols, whoring, things strangled, and from blood, all have to do with idolatrous practices. So these are their rites of separation. You separate out by keeping these four things. That's how you separate from your old person. And remember, the death and rebirth, that's what a baptism is. A mikveh is a death and rebirth, a symbolic death and rebirth. And if you read the next line there, for from ancient generations, Moshe has in every city those who proclaim him, being read in the congregations every Shabbat. So very clearly, what they're talking about here is these are the things that you have to do to separate out from your old person, because in every generation, in every city, they always are teaching Moses. They're teaching the Torah throughout the land. So we separate out and then let them enter into that transitional period where they can be taught the Torah every year, every Shabbat. They learn the Torah until they reach that final point. And what's that final point? That's where circumcision happens. Remember, our father Abraham did not get circumcised the day that Yahweh told him to get up and leave his land. It was like 20-something years later before he ever got circumcised. He had to separate out from who he was and then walk by faith and learn how to live that covenant lifestyle before he was circumcised, before he had that sign of the covenant on him. Now, as soon as he left his land, he became a Hebrew. He became an Ivrit, one who was crossed over. But he was not... He didn't have the sign of the covenant. He didn't have full incorporation into God's nation of Israel at that time. So here in here what we see here is that as soon as this person has the mikvah, their confession of faith, and they separate out from idolatry, they are Israel. They are Israel. You know, just like as soon as I went to boot camp, I was a military member. I was in the U.S. Navy, but I was still learning how to operate my function. So I didn't have the full rights and responsibilities. They didn't expect me to keep, you know, to salute properly every time I saw an officer from the day I walked into boot camp. They had to teach me how to do the proper salute, how to walk in perfect step with everyone else. They didn't expect you to do these things the minute you show up at boot camp. So why would we expect someone who's just coming into the faith, and remember, when we're talking about coming into the faith, we're talking about coming into Torah. Because if you don't have Torah, you're not really, I'd say you aren't really in the fullness of the faith. So why would we expect a person coming into Torah to fully be walking in Torah the minute they cross that threshold? Absolutely not. Let's look at some of what Paul wrote about here. Let's turn to Romans 6, and we'll go through some different verses here. Yeah, Romans 6, verse 5 and 6. For if we have come to be grown together in the likeness of his death, we shall be also of the resurrection. Knowing this, our old man has been impaled, so that the body of sin might be rendered powerless to serve sin no longer. So what he's saying is here is that we've gone through that rite of separation. Our old man is dead. You are no longer who you were. You have been separated out. You are now moving into that transitional period. Let's look again. Let's go to Ephesians 4. Ephesians 4, verse 22. Let's go start in verse 20 for some context. But you have not so learned Messiah. If indeed you have learned him and were taught by him, as truth is in Yeshua, have you put off, with regards to your former way of life, the old man, being corrupted and according to the desires of deceit, and have been renewed in spirit of your mind, that you have put on the renewed man, which was created according to Elohim in the righteousness and set apartness of truth. So, if you have not left, if you confess Messiah, if you went through baptism and you are still acting the same way that you were before you accepted Messiah Yeshua, there is something wrong. You are not a new man like you're supposed to be. The whole concept here was that you are no longer a Gentile. You leave those pagan ways. You leave that lifestyle. And oftentimes that's going to even mean leaving friends, leaving even family members, if that's what it takes, right? I mean, that's what Yeshua says. I will give you even greater things if you leave these things for my sake. You can't, and I'm not saying you should just immediately shun anyone who doesn't believe the same way you do. We maintain those connections, but if that person is trying to drag you down, you have to cut that off. You have to become that new man, lead that lifestyle according to Yeshua. Keep the Torah according to Yeshua's instructions, not according to how you used to live. You need to be a different person once you've gone through this this confession of faith, this baptism, this mikvah, becoming a new man. Let's look again at Colossians 3, verse 5. Colossians 3, verse 5. Therefore, put to death your members which are on this earth, whoring, uncleanliness, passion, evil desire, greed of gain, which is idolatry. Those things are no longer a part of your life. You put to death those things which were in your past because those are idolatry. And we go down to verse 9. Do not lie to each other, since you have put off the old man with his practices. That's what he's talking about here. And have put on the new one, who is renewed in knowledge according to the likeness of him who created him. There is neither Greek nor Yehudite, Jew, circumcised or uncircumcised, foreigner, Scythian, slave, free, but Messiah is all and in all. So where did Paul learn these concepts from? Remember when, after the road to Emmaus and all that thing, what did he do? He went into Arabia for 3 years. Now, what was he doing there? We don't know. That was his transitional period. But somewhere during that way, I fully believe that through the Ruach, and maybe he found he was studying manuscripts, I don't know. Somehow, when Paul changed, he learned some stuff that just, I guarantee, was blowing people away. You think that Rico and the things that Rico's been teaching in this last couple year, and then me and Daniel have been helping him with the ancient Near East, you think that stuff is profound? Think of Paul, who knew, I mean, he had the whole scripture memorized, and he goes in there, and he comes out, and all this stuff that we're finding, this is stuff that Paul was talking about. Paul came out, I guarantee you think that people are blown away by Rico, you should have seen Paul. He had people coming out, and I'm not putting down Rico, I love Rico, man. But I guarantee you, Paul was just like that. I almost wonder if he wasn't didn't talk a little bit of with an accent to really get people riled up there, you know. But anyways, Paul had people on fire. I mean, he had thousands and thousands of people. I can't remember the verses, but talks. I mean, people just thronged to Paul. Why is that? What was it about him that just brought people in and blew them away? I would venture to guess, based on all this stuff, because I mean, I'll tell you, every time I talk to Rico and every time I talk to Daniel McGurr, we're always like, man, Paul really knew what he was talking about. Now that we've studied these ancient ways and we go, oh, that's what Paul was talking about. I mean, Paul was just, he was a genius. And so I believe that the Spirit led him out into the wilderness and showed him the ancient ways, the ancient pathways, these ancient Near Eastern concepts, these rites of passage, so he could make these connections in his mind and be able to really relate them to people. So after these rites of separation and the rites in the life of a believer, we then would move on to the weekly Torah study. This is your training period. You're under the tutor of the Torah during this time frame. That's what we were just reading in Acts 15. Now I want to read some more verses so we can really point out and where Paul and some of the other writers are talking about this. Let's turn to John 16. Verse 7. This is Yeshua speaking after he's resurrected. He says, "But I say the truth to you. It is better for you that I go away, for if I do not go away, the Helper shall come to you all. But if I go, I shall send him to you. And having come, he shall reprove the world of or the world concerning sin and concerning righteousness and concerning judgment. Concerning the sin, because they do not believe in me. Concerning righteousness, because I go to my Father and you will see me no more. Concerning judgment, because the ruler of this world is judged. I still have many words to say to you, but you are not able to bear them now. But when he comes, the Spirit of truth, he shall guide you into all truth, for he shall not speak from himself, but whatever he hears, he shall speak, and he shall announce it to you when he comes." Right there. He shall guide you in all truth. What does your teacher in school do? They guide you in truth. Right? They are your tutor. Just the same concepts going on here. That you, dear, once Yeshua leaves, that the people will now, because remember, we have the conversion from Gentile to Israelite, but we also have, as a nation, Israel will be under the tutor of this tutorage of the Spirit. We're going through that transitional period, that period of ambiguity, that period of danger before we are fully incorporated into the kingdom. Because let's face it right now, while we have the kingdom of God in our hearts, we are not in the kingdom. We don't live in the land of Israel with one nation and one king, right? So we aren't fully incorporated in. We're still in that transitional period. So we have the Spirit to be the helper, to be the tutor to guide us. We can also look at Hebrews 5, verse 12 here. "For indeed, although by this time you ought to be teachers, you need someone to teach you again the first elements of the word of Elohim. You have become such as need of milk and not solid food. For everyone partaking in milk is inexperienced in the word of righteousness, for he is a babe. But solid food is for the mature, whose senses have been trained by practice to discern both good and evil." Wow. Those who have been trained, the mature ones, are those whose senses have been trained by practice to discern both good and evil. That is God's intent for us, is that we mature enough so that we can discern between good and evil, that we can be like priests. Because what was the duty of the priests? They are to discern between the holy and the profane, and the clean and the unclean, the good and the evil. That we are meant to be those judges. That's what we're to judge angels. And so we have to go through that learning phase. We have to be trained through practice, through trials, through tribulations, to discern both good and evil, right? And we're supposed to achieve that in our lives at some point, but as a body, as a nation, we will also achieve that in the future, right? And we'll talk about that a little bit more near the end of this. Let's turn to Galatians 3, verse 21 through 25. Man, I love Paul. He's such an amazing guy. Here, Galatians 3, verse 21 through 25. Remember, everyone thinks that Paul was against the Torah. Let's see if Paul was against the Torah. Let's see, what does he say here? Let's just go up. Let's start in verse 16 here. But the promises were spoken to Abraham and to his seed. He does not say, and to seeds, but as of many, but as to one, to your seed, who is Messiah. Now I say this, Torah, which came 430 years later, does not annul a covenant previously confirmed by Elohim in Messiah so as to do away with the promise. Now, let me ask you this. Does the renewed covenant, the new covenant, which came 1,500 years later approximately, does that annul the covenant previously confirmed by Elohim? No. For if the inheritance is by Torah, it is no longer by promise. But Elohim gave it to Abraham as a promise. The Torah is a different type of covenant. It's a suzerain-vassal relationship. That covenant with Abraham was a royal grant covenant. Verse 19. Why then the Torah? It was added because of transgression until the seed should come to whom the promise was made, and it was ordained through messengers in the hand of the mediator. The mediator, however, is not one of us, but Elohim is one, Echad. Is the Torah against the promises of Elohim? Let it not be. For if the law had been given that was able to make alive, truly righteousness would have been by Torah. What he's saying there is that's not the function of the Torah. The purpose of the Torah was not to make you alive. It wasn't to give you eternal life and salvation. That was what the covenant with Abraham was all about. That was a royal land grant and a royal priesthood grant, a royal life grant, if you want to call it. That's what God did with Abraham. He promised that to Abraham and his descendants that they would be resurrected and that they would live in the land eternally. The Torah was not able to make alive because that was not the function of it. The Torah was saying, now that you've been made alive, this is how I want you to live. These are my instructions for how you are to live in my presence. Verse 22, but the scripture has shut up all mankind under sin, that the promise by belief in Yeshua Messiah might be given to those who believe. But before belief came, read this with me, we were guarded under Torah, having been shut up for the belief being about to be revealed. And then again here, therefore the Torah became our trainer unto Messiah, in order to be declared right by belief. And after belief has come, we are no longer under the trainer. We'll talk about that there in a second, what that means. For you are all sons of Elohim through belief in Messiah Yeshua. For as many as you... Well, and we already read that. Okay, so let's talk about what's going on here. We were guarded under Torah. Therefore, the Torah became our trainer unto Messiah. And once belief has come, we are no longer under a trainer. Now, let me ask you this. If Paul was trying to say that the Torah no longer needs to be kept. Couldn't he have just said that? Couldn't he have just said, you don't have to keep Torah? Did they not have words for that in the Hebrew, the Aramaic, and the Greek language? Did they have no way of expressing that? Did they have to come up with all these flowery, under the Torah, no longer under the trainer? No, because that's not what he was telling us. He was not saying, we don't have to keep the Torah. He wasn't, and I come from an Adventist background where they go, oh, well, we recognize that you got to keep the Ten Commandments, but obviously Paul was talking about the ceremonial law. Excuse me? Can you show me one place in the Bible where the term ceremonial law is and where it says we don't have to keep the ceremonial law, where we're allowed to somehow discern which parts of God's laws we can keep? Gee, I remember someone else trying to say, oh, God didn't really mean what he said, somewhere back in, you know, Genesis 3. That's not what Paul is saying. He's not trying to split apart the Torah or do away with the Torah. He's using specific language that comes from these concepts that we have termed now the rites of passage. You are no longer under the trainer. Doesn't mean that you don't keep the Torah. Let me ask you this. When you graduate from high school, you are no longer under your teacher. You're no longer a student of your teacher. Does that mean that suddenly 2 plus 2 equals 6? Or 4 divided by 2 equals 8? No. The laws are eternal. The knowledge is eternal. You still have to live in a world that operates by the things that you were instructed in. You still have to do these things. You still have to know how to do these things, but you're no longer being trained in these things. You're no longer, you know, think about this. When you first came to Torah, I bet you studied, I mean, it was like, it's everything's new and you're just studying, you're trying to learn how to do it and everything. After you've been doing Torah, and I'm not saying I'm an expert, but you know, I've talked to people and I observe people. After 15 years in the Torah, 20 years in the Torah, you don't have to, every scenario, you don't have to go back there and flip through your Bible and see which, you know, you know what's kosher and what's not. You don't need to be instructed. You don't need to flip open your Bible and do a comparison because you know, you've learned how to walk in that way. And so you're no longer being trained. You're living the Torah. You're not being trained by the Torah. You are living the Torah. And that is what Paul is saying here in Galatians. He's not saying that the Torah is no longer relevant because we have Messiah. That is an absurd statement, especially taking into account all of Yeshua's statements about the Torah and even Paul's statements about the Torah. You know, he oftentimes talks about, yes, you keep the Torah. And then, you know, we go down here. Remember what we read a little bit earlier, or in verse 28. Therefore, there is neither Jew nor Greek, there is not slave nor free, there's not male and female, but you are all one in Messiah Yeshua. This is right after he talks about being immersed in Messiah. Now he's kind of switching over that we are no longer these factions. We are now incorporated into the full body of believers, right? And we can also kind of relate this to this feeling of ambiguity, right? We're all, how many of you have been in like an identity crisis? You don't know who you are, what you're supposed to be doing, right? Am I a Jew? Am I a 10 triber? Am I this? Am I that? Am I really a Gentile who snuck into the kingdom? You know, where do I fit? Which laws do I keep? What stuff's applicable today? You're in that transitional period. You're in that state of ambiguity. And that's what Paul there is talking about, I believe, and I propose to you as well. Let's look at John 15, verse 19 next. John 15, verse 19. If you were... let's go up for a little bit more context. And this is him talking to the disciples. You did not choose me. This is verse 16. You did not choose me, but I chose you and appointed you that you should go and bear fruit, and that your fruit should remain, so that whatever you ask the Father in my name, he might give you. That's kind of interesting. You have to bear fruit so that your fruit may remain, so that whatever you ask of the Father in my name, he shall give you. To me, it's kind of sounding there. If you're not bearing fruit, the Father is not gonna give you what you ask in the name of Yeshua. Kind of interesting, a little off topic, but very interesting. These words I commanded you so that you love one another. That these devarim, these words, dabar, just the same thing as Deuteronomy, it's like the covenant, so that you might love one another, be faithful, be loyal. That's what the word love meant in the ancient Near East. If the world hates you, and you know that it hated me before it hated you, but you were of the world, if you were of the world would love its own. But because you are not of the world, I have chosen you out of the world. For that reason, the world hates you. What did we talk about during the rites of transition? They are oftentimes separated out from society. Just like the priests, during that 7-day period, they were separated out. They had to stay within the temple grounds and be separated from the rest of society, separated from their family. The leper, the same thing. He was allowed into the camp, but he was separated out from being included into the houses. That same concept there. You know what? Let's take a quick break here, and we'll come back in the second in another part here.